Okay. Well, thank you all for joining us on this call titled Long-Term Services, Supports, and Housing, Choices and Advocacy. My name is Jessica Brill-Ortiz, and I'm the Program Manager at the National Consumer Voice for Quality Long-Term Care, which is known as the Consumer Voice for short. The Consumer Voice is a national, nonprofit consumer advocacy organization founded in 1975 to advocate for quality care and quality of life for consumers in all long-term care settings, and we're so pleased to be hosting this call today. First, I'd like to share the call logistics. All participant lines are muted, and they'll stay muted throughout the call. There will be five speakers and time following the speaker panel for question and answer. To submit a question, please email it to me at any point during today's call, and we'll answer as many questions as possible during the question and answer portion. Just as a reminder, my email address is jbrill, B as in boy, R-I-L-L, Ortiz, O-R-T-I-Z, at theconsumervoice.org. Today's call is the first of a five-call series to educate and engage consumers and other advocates on key issues related to home and community-based services and long-term services and supports, as well as strategies for how to be effective advocates to help about improvement in quality care and quality of life for consumers of long-term services and supports. This call series is part of the Consumer Voice Initiative, which is called Consumers for Quality Care No Matter Where, and it focuses on issues faced by consumers who are receiving services and supports in non-nursing home settings. Through this initiative, we're working to build a strong consumer voice to advocate for well-coordinated, accessible, and quality long-term services and supports, both at home and in the community. Also as part of the initiative, we're partnering with organizations in five pilot states, which are California, New Mexico, Ohio, Vermont, and Virginia, again, to advocate for improved quality and to develop models of consumer engagement. And the goal is to educate and really mobilize consumers around state and national policy issues that relate to home and community-based services. If you'd like to learn more about this initiative and how to get involved, I encourage you to visit Consumer Voice's website, which is, again, www.theconsumervoice.org. So now on to our official call. As I'm sure you know, our long-term care system is complicated and it can be difficult to figure out how to get quality services that fit your needs. Often, people don't know where to turn for information or how to navigate their way to good care. The system and the process can be absolutely overwhelming. So we've developed today's call to help make the system and the process of finding care less overwhelming. We'll provide an introduction to long-term services and supports in home and community-based settings, and we'll also talk about housing rights and ways to overcome barriers to obtaining affordable and accessible housing. Today's call focuses on home and community-based services, which are also known as HCBS. We won't be talking about nursing homes or assisted living facilities today, because those are considered residential settings and not included under the HCBS umbrella. So let's get started with a definition of long-term services and supports, which are also known as LTSS or long-term care. Long-term services and supports are assistance for the tasks of everyday life to help people live as independently as possible. Long-term services and supports are often used by older adults who have at least one chronic condition that makes activities like getting dressed or taking a shower harder. Chronic condition might be something like in addition to older adults, individuals of any age with a disability may also need long-term services and supports. So long-term services and supports are often divided into two categories. The first is activities of daily living, or ADLs, and these are tasks to care for your body and move your body. This includes things like getting bathed, getting dressed, going to the bathroom, getting around, and eating. The second kind of long-term services and supports are called instrumental activities of daily living, or IADLs. And these are things meant to help you live independently and to help you do the things that are part of everyday life. So these could include things like making meals and cleaning up after them, shopping, housework, managing money, and taking medication. These kinds of services, both the activities of daily living and the instrumental activities of daily living, can be provided voluntarily by a family member or a friend or by paid caregivers. Now I'd like to talk about some of the most commonly used long-term services and supports at home and in the community. In the home setting, there are services and supports like personal care, which is help with activities of daily living, and it's provided through an agency or an attendant that's hired by the consumer or by family or friends. Another home setting support are homemaker services, which is when someone helps with household things like vacuuming, dusting, doing dishes, etc. A third example of home-based services and supports are home or environmental modifications, and this would include things like adapting an existing home to make it more accessible, safer to get around in. So that would be something like adding wider doors or adding ramps within a home. In the community setting, there are services and supports like adult day services, and these provide social and therapeutic and also recreational activities for adults who have mental or cognitive or physical impairments. Another example of community-based supports are senior centers, and these provide a multitude of services for things like health and nutrition, referrals, etc. I want to stress that long-term services and supports should be person-centered, which means the individual receiving the service and support is directing or guiding the services, as well as when and how the services and supports are received. Person-directed or person-centered care puts the individual in charge and gives them the opportunity to make choices at every level of their daily life. There are many more examples of various home and community-based services and supports on the handouts that you received for this call. So I encourage you to take a look at those for more information and additional details. Next, you'll hear from Robin Grant, who's the Director of Advocacy and Outreach at the Consumer Voice, and she'll be sharing with you about some home and community-based housing options. Robin?
Thank you, Jessica. As Jessica said, I'm going to talk with you about what your home might be if you're receiving long-term services and supports at home or in the community. The fact sheet that you all got as one of the handouts that's related to housing talks in detail. So I just want to highlight a few key points about housing. So obviously you may already be living in your own house or apartment when you need services. You may rent an apartment or a home or own it. So the first option you have is to receive care and services in that house or apartment, which is exactly what the vast majority of people want to do. And sometimes people modify their homes in some way to make it easier for them to stay there. And Jessica referred to an example like building a ramp. You might add grab bars or put a walk-in or roll-in shower in. So you can see what you can do to make your home easier for you to get around. But sometimes where you're living just won't work for you anymore, or you might even be moving out of a nursing home and be looking for housing in the community. So if that's the case, what are your options? Well, you might be able to move in with a family member, or if you're 55 and older, or in some cases 62 or older, senior housing might be a possibility. So these are usually apartments in an apartment complex that is just for older adults. And sometimes that's all it is, just apartments for seniors. And other times, it's an apartment plus things like transportation, maybe one or more meals a day, a social center, things like that might be included but might not be. Of course, in the best of all worlds, we'd all be extremely wealthy, and paying for housing wouldn't be a problem. But that's not the case for most of us. So I want to tell you about some housing options for low-income older adults and persons with disabilities. These options are available through the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, which is referred to as HUD. So for our purposes today, I'm going to focus just on apartments. So there are basically three types of HUD housing options for apartments. The one that is used a lot and that people really like is called the Housing Choice Voucher, which is often called Section 8. So if you qualify, you get a housing voucher that covers all or part of the rent in an apartment. You can then take that voucher and find your own place. And you have a choice of apartments then that private owners agree to rent out. So how this works is that these private owners agree that they will only accept the voucher payment in full or as partial payment, so you don't have to add on to the rent amount. And so often what happens here is that there may be an apartment building or a complex where some of the apartments, but not all of the apartments, are Section 8. So the housing choice voucher is one option. A second HUD option is privately owned subsidized housing, and this is where HUD gives funding to owners of private apartment buildings so they can rent out apartments at reduced rates. And then the third HUD option is public housing apartments. These are apartments in a housing project, and the apartments rent at a rate that is less than the going rate or the market rate. The one last type of housing that I just want to briefly mention is called supportive housing, and this is usually an apartment with a wide range of services that are available, and that could be services like personal care, housekeeping, help with medications, and other services. So HUD also offers this type of housing. So there's supportive housing for the elderly, which is called Section 202. There's supportive housing for persons with disabilities called Section 811. And there are also supportive living programs for people with developmental disabilities, mental illness, or brain injuries. And in that setting, a very small number of people share their own apartment, and services are brought in. The last thing I just want to mention are the terms subsidized, affordable, and accessible. So in your handout, I explain what these terms mean. But I wanted to issue a big, big word of warning. Don't make any assumptions when looking for a place. If you're interested in housing that claims to be subsidized, affordable, or accessible, check it out. Ask what they mean when they use those terms. Because the term affordable, for instance, doesn't always mean what the general definition might be, which is no more than 30% of your income. It might be that, but it might not. And accessible doesn't always mean that the apartment is accessible to you. So if you don't clarify these terms first, you're likely to end up with an apartment that you can't afford and you can't get around. So be a smart consumer. And in closing, I want to just point out that in your handout, you'll find information about where to look for information about housing. And with that, I'll turn things back over to you, Jessica.
Great. Thank you, Robin. Now that we've heard about some home and community-based housing options, I'd like to welcome Bonnie Milstein, Director of the Housing Policy for the Bazelon Center for Mental Health Law, and also co-chair of the Consortium of Citizens with Disabilities Housing Task Force. Bonnie will be speaking today about your housing rights and overcoming barriers to obtaining affordable, accessible housing. Bonnie?
Thank you. Hello, everybody. This is, we don't really don't have very much time to cover a lot, and Jessica, I invite you to cut me off if I go over the amount of time I'm supposed to use. thank you. So talking about housing rights for people with disabilities is really very exciting for me because up until 1973, all of the civil rights laws dealt with people of color, people from different countries, people speaking different languages, women, and the civil rights laws themselves, at least the enforceable civil rights laws, are really a 20th century phenomenon. What happened in 1973 was that disability advocates who had participated in the civil rights movement and actions of the 60s got Congress to change a law that had originally been passed for returning World War I veterans to say that any entity that receives federal financial funds could not use those funds to either establish or perpetuate discrimination against people with disabilities. And the reason this was such a big deal was because until 1973, whenever anybody talked about disabilities, they usually talked about benefits like Social Security and other monetary benefits. Starting in 73, the world view of people with disabilities started to change, slowly, but started to change. And we're talking about people with both mental and physical disabilities. And the way it changed was that instead of focusing on the person's disability, that is, whether an individual had cerebral palsy or intellectual disabilities or mental disabilities, the focus shifted to barriers in the environment that were preventing people from going to school, riding transportation, moving out of their parents' homes and out of nursing homes and into their own housing. The next law that was really critical in the civil rights of people with disabilities was the Fair Housing Act. And it was, even though it was originally enacted in 1968, it was amended in 1988 to cover individuals with disabilities. And so it expanded rights to housing in all housing, not just publicly subsidized housing, but private housing. And for the first time, required that all housing, including private housing, that was built after 1991 and that was multifamily housing, which is to say four or more units of housing, had to include accessibility features. So, you know, from a very common sense perspective, the law requires buildings, let's say elevator buildings, with more than four units to incorporate accessibility into 100% of the units, which means if you have a mobility impairment and you use crutches or canes or wheelchairs, you have to be able to get through the front door, travel down the hallways, get into the apartments, use the kitchens, use the bathrooms. So a new version of accessibility was adopted for housing throughout the country. I'd like to be able to tell you that because of this law, all new apartment buildings are built according to these accessibility features, but unfortunately that is not the case. So that's the bad news. The good news is that the latest estimates are that at least 60% of new apartment buildings are built accessible, and in areas where there is strong fair housing and disability rights advocacy, the percentage is much higher. But if you find an apartment building that was built or renovated after 1991 and you can't get in the front door with your wheelchair or your walker, you can hire a private lawyer, or you can go to Fair Housing Office, or you can even call the city and force the building to either make itself accessible or modify itself so that you can use and live in one of the apartments. You have four documents that I sent to Jessica. The documents are documents that I pulled off the web. If you put housing and disability into whatever search engine you use, you'll come up with lots of resources. Every state has fair housing resources. So the first document that I've given you, I just pulled down from the Fair Housing Law Project in Silicon Valley in California. It is a very brief definition of what the fair housing laws, how the laws define disability, which we covered. I think one of the most useful parts of this document is that it gives examples of discrimination. So if you're following along on the document, this is near the end of the second page of this document. And not everyone is clear on what constitutes discrimination. So if you're looking for an apartment or you're hiring a real estate agent to help you find a house, these are examples of discriminatory statements. That is to say, if your realtor or the housing manager says these things to you or asks you these questions, it reflects the fact that they don't understand their responsibilities under the Fair Housing Act. So they are, can you live independently? Your wheelchair will damage the carpet and the walls, so I'm not going to rent to you. No, you may not install grab bars in the bathroom. This is a no pets building. You may not bring your service animal or your companion animal into this apartment. I can't rent it to you. Who will take care of you? What if there's a fire? If I let you come in with your service animal, I'd have to let everyone have a pet, so I can't rent to you. You and your live-in aide don't qualify for a two-bedroom unit. Sorry, our new building is not handicap accessible. If the two aspects of Section 504, the law that was enacted in 1973, and the Fair Housing Act in 88, and the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is the disability rights law that most people are familiar with, both people with disabilities and people without disabilities, was enacted in 1990. And they all affect your housing rights. But the two aspects of all three laws that have been most helpful to people with disabilities has been the reasonable accommodation requirements and the reasonable modification requirements. The reasonable modification requirements say that landlords must allow tenants to make physical changes to the interior of their apartments if the physical changes are necessary for someone to be able to make their apartment usable. So let's say you've been a renter in a particular apartment for several years. And you have a stroke, or your MS gets worse, or you just age, and you begin to acquire age-related disabilities. Your arthritis makes it difficult for you to walk or to turn the doorknob. Your landlord has to allow you to change a doorknob to a door lever. The landlord has to allow you to install grab bars in the bathroom. If it's possible to do that safely. And if you need if you've had a stroke, for example, and you've been living in a third floor apartment and you can no longer negotiate the stairs and there's no elevator in the building, if there is a ground floor apartment at the same rent that you're paying, or it's higher and you can pay the higher rent and it's vacant, the landlord has to allow you to move to the first floor. I've just done a combination of modifications and accommodations. So on the last example that I gave you, that is you can no longer negotiate stairs and you need to be in a ground floor apartment, that's a reasonable accommodation. That is to say, landlords have to modify rules that they have in order to allow you to use your apartment. The disability rights laws and the more traditional, older civil rights laws prohibiting discrimination on the basis of gender or race or national origin is that for the older civil rights laws, the only changes that are necessary are to stop affirmatively discriminating. So, for example, if a housing provider only wants to rent to white people, that obviously violates the civil rights laws. So the landlord has to stop doing that and start renting to people of all races and color, as long as they can pay the rent and meet all the other objective criteria. That approach doesn't work for people with disabilities. It obviously works if a landlord just says, oh, I'm never going to rent to a disabled person. But if the landlord doesn't want to rent to somebody using a wheelchair or needs to build a ramp or allow a tenant to build a ramp to gain access to the apartment, or rent to a tenant who uses a service animal or a companion animal, or sometimes called an emotional support animal, then the landlord needs to do something atypical, and that's where the reasonable modifications and the reasonable accommodation rules are so important. I've used up my time to talk about housing rights, and I'm supposed to start talking about overcoming barriers to obtaining affordable, accessible housing. So I have begun to talk about those in the context of accommodation and modification. And I take lots of technical assistance calls from people, and the most frequent call I get is, I have a service animal, or I have a mental disability, and I have a companion animal, and my landlord is telling me that or the condo association is telling me that this is a no pets building, and so I cannot have my service animal or my companion animal in the house with me. And if you'll look at the next document that says at the top, the reasonable accommodation dance, what this two-page document does is tell you how to ask for a reasonable accommodation. The dance is an acronym for the five elements of a reasonable accommodation. So in order to get an accommodation, you have to acknowledge that you have a disability. If you're already using a wheelchair, then it should be obvious to the landlord that you have a disability. But if you're not willing to acknowledge that you have a disability, if you have, for example, a hidden disability, like a mental disability, or a disability whose disabling aspects are not always apparent, and you want to make a change in your apartment, the first thing you have to do is acknowledge that you have a disability. And the second thing you have to do, the A in dance, is you have to ask for an accommodation. The third thing that you need to do is to tell the landlord what accommodation you need, and the accommodation has to be connected to what your disability is. So if you use a wheelchair, for example, you want the landlord to put in a swimming pool, it's not obvious that there's any relationship between your use of a wheelchair and your desire for a swimming pool. But if, for example, the building or the project already has a swimming pool or has a, more commonly, a laundry room, but getting to the laundry room requires you to go up steps or down steps, then you're asking for a ramp to be built so that you can get to the laundry room is the kind of accommodation that you can connect to the fact that you use a wheelchair or a walker or a cane. The fourth aspect of a reasonable accommodation is cost. Housing providers have to understand that they are expected to spend some money to make their housing accessible and usable to people with disabilities. Most accommodations actually don't cost anything. So allowing somebody to bring a service animal into their apartment and into the building costs nothing. But if there are attributes of the housing that everybody has access to, like a laundry room, for example, or the mail room, or a conference room, then all of those areas must be accessible to people with disabilities. And the upper limit of the cost that a landlord can be asked to bear is an undue financial and administrative burden. So that's been defined in various ways, but it is always much more than the cost of a ramp. And finally, the E in dance stands for effect or extraordinary. That is to say, if you're asking for a swimming pool because you use a wheelchair, not only is there no connection between your disability and the accommodation you're requesting, but if there is not already a swimming pool on the property, then you're asking the landlord to make a fundamental alteration in the nature of the program. You're asking the landlord to add something that the landlord is not already providing as part of the housing. To overcome barriers to obtaining affordable, accessible housing, probably the most important information that I can give you, if you haven't already found this to be true, is that since the inclusion of disability rights in the Fair Housing Act in 1988, there has been an increase in the number of state and local laws, state and local civil rights laws that have incorporated disability rights. And that means two things. That means that your local and state civil rights organizations, human rights organizations, and local government offices that are responsible for ensuring that all of the city and town and state operations are conducted in compliance with the civil rights laws, all have experience enforcing the disability rights laws as well. So the third document that I have given you is the home page of the National Fair Housing Alliance. In addition to the city and the town and the state fair housing organizations, there are also private fair housing organizations. And in order to find out whether Detroit or Hartford or Los Angeles has local fair housing organizations, you can just type in fair housing in Los Angeles or fair housing in Dayton into your search engine. And if you have a local fair housing organization, it should show up on your screen as one of the listed organizations. But you can also go to the NAFA website, the National Fair Housing website, click on your state, and it will bring up the names of fair housing organizations. So if there is not a fair housing organization in your town, but you go to the National Fair Housing Alliance website and you click on Ohio, it will show you fair housing organizations in the state. Fair housing organizations, like legal services and legal aid organizations, do not charge for their services. So they can either help you directly or they can refer you to other no-cost or low-cost organizations to help you with reasonable accommodations, reasonable modifications, and accessibility questions. And finally, both the last document that's in the collection that I sent to Jessica is from the Fair Housing Council of Suburban Philadelphia. And I included this because this particular page refers to a document that HUD and the U.S. Department of Justice drafted and posted on both their websites back in 1994 and continues to be document of major importance. It is the federal government's discussion and question and answer format of what reasonable accommodations are and what housing provider responsibilities are under the Fair Housing Act for reasonable accommodations. They did a second one on reasonable modifications and a third one on zoning laws, specifically on housing for people with disabilities. Since they did their zoning law document, we've made great progress in housing for people with disabilities. So housing, preferred housing, is mainstream housing as opposed to housing that is identifiable as housing for people with disabilities. But what this particular HUD Justice Department document does is it answers this list of questions about who's covered by the Fair Housing Law and what are the responsibilities of housing providers, and if you ask for a reasonable accommodation, what questions can the landlord ask? And if your disability is not an obvious disability, what kind of information can a housing provider ask from you when you want to rent an apartment, when you want to ask for a reasonable accommodation? If you need a personal care attendant to live with you, can you get a two-bedroom rather than a one-bedroom apartment? Can the landlord require your personal care attendant to sleep on a couch in the living room? All the kinds of questions that make an enormous difference in whether or not you're going to be able to use your apartment. So my time is almost up, not quite up, but I prefer to answer questions. We'll have questions at the end of this session. So I am going to turn my unused 3 minutes back over to Jessica so we can have our next speaker.
All right. Well, thank you, Bonnie, for your presentation and for your extra minutes. Now we'll hear from Sarah Kaplan, who's an independent living advocate at the Boston Center for Independent Living. Sarah will be sharing with you about additional factors and tips related to overcoming barriers to affordable, accessible housing. Sarah?
Hi, everybody. Again, I'm Sarah Kaplan, and I'm from the Boston Center for Independent Living in Boston. I have both personal and professional experience looking for housing. I work at BCIL, and we do a lot of housing advocacy, but I have also personally moved from the Midwest to a large city, being Boston, and had to find housing, and had to do it rather quickly. On the ground, the number one question that I get is, I get a phone call on Monday saying, I need a wheelchair accessible house by Friday. And that can be difficult, if not impossible, to make happen. So the first thing I normally ask a consumer who calls me is, what do you really need and what are you willing to give up? These questions, you know, nobody wants to give up everything. You know, everybody wants to live in a place that's perfectly accessible for them, and they live independently, and I get that. But if you are in a situation where you need to move from your nursing home, for example, and you need to do it, rather quickly, I apologize, I'm at a school, that you must leave rather quickly, then the question is, what are you willing to give up? For me, it's a question of location, complete and total accessibility, or transportation and funds. So I decided that I was willing to move farther out from the city, losing the location, but still keeping access in terms of physical barriers, and housing was more important to me than living inside the city. When I was looking for housing, I knew for me personally, I needed a fully ADA compliant unit, and I needed a unit with a walk-in shower. So it's very important to know what you need up front, because a lot of units, if you're looking for accessible housing, you call a new building, and they will say things like, all of our units are accessible. You can get inside the door. Well, that's not really true if you can't use the bathroom. And I know that, and you know that, but the landlord has a harder idea understanding why you don't call their house accessible. So, there definitely are ways to look for home modification resources, but it comes down to what are you willing to give up, what do you really need, and how fast do you need to get it. I provided one document I did provide this call was a document from HUD. It's actually not from our organization. It's from Housing and Urban Development, please. And this is a document that shows how much a Section 8 is worth by county, by state, by county. And the reason that's important is that the value of a Section 8, especially a mobile Section 8, varies across the board. And so if you can, a mobile Section 8 moves literally around the country, your Section 8 will be worth more in California than it will be in Idaho. So it's good to know what those numbers are if you're so lucky to get a Section 8. It's also important to understand that when you're applying for housing, when you're applying for housing assistance like Section 8 or other sort of housing assistance, that it's usually a longer process. In Boston, for example, I like to tell people that emergency applications take a year. Non-emergency applications can take anywhere from 3 to 5 years. If you want to live in Boston, good luck. You're looking at a 10-year wait. So it's important to contact your ILCs and also your local housing authorities to see what kind of wait you're looking at if you're looking to get a hold of one of those Section 8s or one of those houses that are less expensive based on income. In terms of federal agencies that help with home modifications, there's HUD's Community Development Block Grant Program. It's a federally funded program designed to help small cities and towns meet a broad range of community development initiatives. Some communities may choose to use these funds for home modifications or repairs. U.S. Development for Agriculture and Rural Development has home improvement loans and grants. The Department of Veterans Affairs also can have funds. And then there's an organization that I know called Home for Our Troops, which also may have some home modification funds. You also may want to look at disability-specific organizations, UCP, MDA, things like that. But if you need to move rather quickly, one thing I do suggest to people is consider the idea of a roommate, somebody who can share half the rent with you if you're looking at a market rate apartment. And that may not be ideal, but it at least can keep you in the community if you can afford half the rent of a two-bedroom or a third of the rent of a three-bedroom. Also, be upfront with the landlords about your needs. I actually went looking last week, and one of the units I looked at had a tub and a seat. It didn't have a walk-in, so this was not going to be the right space for me, so I couldn't use the shower on my own, and that's very important to me. So it's very important to decide what's important to you and what you're willing to compromise on. And that's a lot of what I have to say. If anyone has any questions, please let me know.
Great. Thank you, Sarah. And just a reminder before our next speaker that if you do have questions about any of these presentations, you can email them to me at jbrillortiz@theconsumervoice.org. So that's J, B as in boy, I-L-L, O-R-T-I-Z, at theconsumervoice.org. So again, thank you, Sarah. At this point, I'd like to turn the call over to Julie Sanchez, who is a consumer in New Mexico. Julie will be sharing her perspective and experience related to finding affordable and accessible housing. Julie? Julie, are you there?
Sorry, I didn't do my mute button. I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, so I didn't do the mute button. Hello, everybody. My name is Julie Sanchez. I live in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I have MS and I'm wheelchair bound. I want to talk about some of the problems I had finding good housing. I spent 3.5 years in a nursing home and finally found out that I was able to transition from there. So looking for some place, I thought I needed help, so I looked for assisted living places. I went to between 5 and 7 assisted living houses to see if I could find housing there, and not one single one of them was wheelchair accessible. And I'm just not good for me. The last one that I went to go see, I had high hopes for because they advertise in the Sunday paper every week, big handicap logo saying ADA certified. I thought this is going to be a great place. So I went there to look and see. It was very terrible. Could not navigate into the bathroom at all. No walk-in shower, no roll-in shower. The kitchen was horrible. It was long and narrow. I could get into it, but I couldn't turn around. Couldn't reach the stove, couldn't reach the sink, no roll under sink. It was pretty bad. So when I actually talked to the manager there, I said that it was not accessible for me. I couldn't move around. She said, well, this was built according to ADA specifications. I really didn't know what to say because, well, they were built that way, but I think I'm considered disabled if I'm in a wheelchair, but it was not doable for me. Okay, so back to the nursing home. Then I got ILRC told me about an apartment, an accessible apartment. I thought, this is great. I thought that was, I really wanted to live in an apartment. I'm somewhat independent, and that was for me. So I went to go see the apartment with some people from the ombudsman's office and other people from Medicaid, and looked at the apartment, and this was, it was pretty bad. I was able to get through the door, but going inside, they had this really thick white shag carpeting all over the living room. I couldn't navigate it with my wheelchair. A person in a walker would not have been able to navigate that either. I was told by the manager that if I wanted to have it removed and replaced with linoleum, I could do that, but it was at my expense. Well, most people with disabilities don't have a lot of money. We're on SSDI, so that means not a lot of money. Well, couldn't afford it. I looked at the stove. The stove had controls in the back. It was an electric stove, controls in the back. Well, you can't do that when you're in a wheelchair. You're going to burn yourself. Once again, I was told that if I wanted to have it switched out to a stove that had controls in the front, I had to do it at my expense. No, not doable. I couldn't reach the sink in the kitchen. No roll under sink. And so I couldn't quite, I could reach the taps, but, you know, I wouldn't be able to wash dishes because I couldn't get close to them. I think that if an apartment is considered accessible, that they just don't put in a couple of grab bars or one grab bar in the bathroom and think that that's it. Or if you do need modifications, that you shouldn't have to pay for it yourself. So that was not doable. I went back to the nursing home and thinking I'm never going to get out of here because I don't think that there's a housing for me. Finally, I was told about an apartment, a complex that had just been built. They had a website. I looked on it, and they said that they had handicap accessible apartments. So, okay. I came and looked at it, and it was wonderful. It was perfect. It was a loft, meaning that there aren't walls, which is easy to maneuver. The only doors in here were in the front and in the bathroom. So very doable. I liked it a lot. It was, let's see. I found out when I was in the nursing home, I contacted the Governor's Commission for Disabilities in Santa Fe and was told that we had something called the 2% rule, meaning that 2% of all apartment complexes in New Mexico were to be accessible. Well, that's wonderful. I didn't know about that. If you're disabled and you need one of these apartments, how do you find out about it? There's no bridge over that. In fact, when I moved into this complex, they have three apartments that were handicap accessible, but they were not rented by people who were handicapped. So that's a big problem. They are rented by people with disabilities now, which makes me happy. So, but I just don't know how to bridge that barrier. Another barrier for apartments is the cost of rent. We have more apartments that have been built in Albuquerque that are for disabled, but they're not cost effective for people. And I don't know how that's going to work because people on disability or people who are on disability SSDI don't have the money. So that's a big problem. I think that's all I have to say. So I will turn it over to Robin. I mean, not Robin, to Jessica. Thank you, Jessica.
Thanks, Julie. Your experience is really valuable, and we, of course, appreciate you sharing it with us. So before we start answering some of the questions that continue to come in over email, I want to underscore that, as we've mentioned, home and community-based services and supports vary widely from one state to another. Also, services, supports, and even the settings may be called different things from state to state, and sometimes the term even means different things in different states. So it's really important to learn what's available to you in your own state. There are numerous resources available to help you do this, to find information about home and community-based services in your state, how to determine what your needs are, and also how to obtain services. One resource is Elder Care Locator. This is a free national service which provides written information about LTSS and can connect you with organizations and agencies in your area and your state. You can contact Elder Care Locator over the phone or online. They have a toll-free number as well as a website, and both of those contact options, the phone number and the website, are on the handouts for this call. When you call Elder Care Locator, one of the agencies you'll be referred to is your Area Agency on Aging, which is also known as your AAA, AAA. AAAs can connect older adults and sometimes younger individuals with disabilities with information about the services that are available in their area. Another resource that you might access are Centers for Independent Living, which are also known as CILs or CILs. CILs are grassroots organizations that are run by and for people with disabilities. They provide disability-specific information and referral services in a particular region. To find your nearby CIL, again, you can call them. There's a toll-free number or visit their website, both of which are in your handouts today. You might also reach out to what some states call an Aging and Disability Resource Center, or an ADRC. Like Area Agencies on Aging and Centers for Independent Living, Aging and Disability Resource Centers provide information about long-term services and supports in your state. I do want to note that not all states have ADRCs statewide, and some states may only have them in a few areas. So to find an ADRC near you, if one exists, there's a toll-free number as well as a website, again, in today's handouts. And then finally, I'll mention the Department of Veterans Affairs. That department has a range of services for veterans who need services and support. And for more information, you can contact the Social Work Department of any VA medical facility by calling their toll-free number or visiting their website. There's a lot of information, additional information about this topic in a Consumer Voice resource that's called Piecing Together Quality Long-Term Care, A Consumer's Guide to Choices and Advocacy. And the guide teaches consumers and advocates about options for long-term services and supports and has information for advocating for quality. The guide is available free on our website in numerous formats, including formats for individuals with visual impairments. The guide is also available for sale in hard copy, so I encourage you to visit our website, which is www.theconsumervoice.org, to look at the guide and access all of the additional information that it provides. So that concludes the formal presentation portion of this call, but now I'd like to open things up for question and answer. Again, as a reminder, we're taking questions via email. So if you have a question that you'd like to pose to any of the presenters, you can send it to me at jbrillortiz@theconsumervoice.org. So So I'll give you some time to do that, and in the meantime, I'll start reading some of the questions that have been coming in. So the first question, in community Medicaid in the home, which is consumer-directed, known as CDPAP, must the aid be paid through an agency, or can they be paid directly through Medicaid if they're a family member or friend? Bonnie, I'm wondering if you are able to speak to that question.
I'm not really an expert on this, so it's very possible somebody else has another answer, but I do know that home health care aides are often paid by the disabled person herself.
In the state of Massachusetts, this is Sarah Kaplan, I apologize. In the state of Massachusetts, Medicaid will pay for PCA services, and it's very confusing to state whether or not the Medicaid services will get paid for, or Medicaid will pay for PCA services. But if you are looking for a PCA program, I would suggest contacting your local ILC first. And then, of course, there's always an option to go private pay through private home health aid and PCA programs, but those are going to be marketably more expensive. So it depends on what you're looking for. There's also, if you do not qualify for Medicaid, then my suggestion is always, if you're going to pay out of pocket, you could look for nursing students or PT students at your local colleges or community colleges when you're doing and interview them and see if they'd be interested in doing a couple hours a week or a couple hours a day out of your pocket. I mean, obviously, a lot of people with disabilities wouldn't be able to afford that, but when you're looking for PCAs, if you have to find them yourself, that's always a good place to go. And also to check your ILC and see if they have any other suggestions.
Jessica?
Yes.
This is Robin. In general, there are many Medicaid programs throughout the country, or either through regular Medicaid or Medicaid waiver, where that will pay for personal care attendance. And so really you need to sort of see what is available in your own state. And Sarah had just mentioned looking for aides. And in some states there are actually registries that a consumer can go to and to find a list of available attendants. So just thought I'd throw that in.
Great. Thank you. Okay, the next question is, where do you turn if you want to file a complaint against a landlord who is not willing to make a reasonable modification or accommodation? Is there an agency responsible for handling complaints? And I'll invite any of our speakers to speak to that.
So this is Bonnie. I'll start. As I said before, there are several places to file complaints. You can file a complaint with HUD, which has a fair housing office and has both regional and local offices. You can file a complaint with your local or state human rights commission or fair housing office. You can file a complaint with the help of a nonprofit private fair housing office. And in many places, you can file complaints with the Realtors Board, or Homeowner Association Board, or Consumer Organization.
In Massachusetts, and I assume across the country, there is a Consumer Office on Disability. So what I would suggest you do, like the Mass Office on Disability has a consumer program that you can file complaints and get assistance through. And I would suggest looking for them, Googling them, just putting in your state and then looking at the Office of Disability and then looking at the consumer section and seeing if you can file them. And they can assist you with what the next step should be.
This is Robin. I actually have a question for Bonnie. Do you have any tips for filing a strong complaint? Anything that people should, should there be a lot of detail in there if you're filing a written complaint? Just wondered if you had any suggestions.
I do. I find that it's often easier dealing with housing organizations than consumer organizations, either housing or disability organizations, in filing a fair housing complaint where the issue is modification or accommodation. But you can use the dance framework for an accommodation or modification complaint, because if you set out in an organized way the fact that you are a person who has a disability, that you need an accommodation, that you've asked for the accommodation, what the accommodation is that you've asked for, or if you're not sure what accommodation you should ask for, what the barrier is to your either getting into the housing or, if you're already in, using the housing that you have. And finally, the response that you've gotten from the housing provider. That gives the HUD or the local fair housing agency or the local CIL or the consumer agency or the human rights organization the kind of framework, both the information and the framework they can use to get back to you and ask for whatever additional information they might need, like the location of the housing or how long ago you asked the landlord for the accommodation. And it will. That's what I recommend. I certainly recommend saying more than "I am a disabled person and my landlord is discriminating against me." That's much too broad. And I also recommend that you not file a request for help or call with a request for help detailing every single exchange that you've had with your landlord. Following the dance framework, giving the essential information should help move your complaint forward much more quickly.
That's really helpful, Bonnie. So that sounds like right from the beginning, when somebody is asking the landlord for accommodation or modification, that needs to be in writing as well.
Well, it depends. I mean, if you have a fairly good relationship with your landlord, and especially if your disability is obvious, so that what you're asking for is to switch out the doorknob for a door lever or move to a ground floor apartment or have a ramp installed, and you think that you're going to get a positive response, then there's no reason, then you should be able to just, call or go over to the rental office and have a conversation. If the landlord says something like, "Oh, I knew I never should have rented to you," or "I don't know what you're talking about, I'm not going to do anything for you that I don't do for everybody else," then that's a good hint that you should put your request in writing to the landlord. And again, it needn't be extensive. It can just say, "Dear Sam, as you know, I use a wheelchair," or "I've lived here for 10 years and now I have to use a wheelchair even though I didn't use one before, and in order to use my apartment, this is what I need, and can we talk about it?" Because the other element that I did not mention in both reasonable accommodation and reasonable accommodation requests is that the laws require landlords to talk to you. So if you make a verbal request or a written request and you don't hear back from the housing provider in what you think is a reasonable amount of time, which is usually longer than 5 minutes, that alone, the refusal to engage in a conversation with you about the accommodation you're asking for, is considered by the courts to be a denial of the accommodation and potentially a violation of the Fair Housing Act.
Wow. I had no idea. That's really helpful. Really helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, so the next question is related to Sarah Kaplan's presentation. The person wrote, Sarah Kaplan talked about needing a fully ADA-compliant apartment. What does a fully ADA-compliant apartment have?
Okay. What a fully ADA-compliant apartment has and what they should have are two different things. It is standard that it's 36-inch doors, that there's usually an open floor plan or a minimally invasive floor plan. For a wheelchair accessible unit, it may be a stovetop. It's just the stovetop that you can roll underneath, and similarly with the kitchen sink, and maybe a raised oven so that it's at your chest level when you open it up. Maybe it's open, like instead of opening one door for a refrigerator, it's two doors. For me, I absolutely need a walk-in shower, but people can get away with, and they do, a tub with a seat in it. Unfortunately, I don't have a computer in front of me, or I would be able to tell you exactly what an ADA unit is supposed to be. I can send that to Jessica if I can find it tomorrow. But when you are looking, again, I think it's very important to decide what you can and can't live with. For me, I need a shower more than anything else, but I could probably live without a stove that I can go underneath as long as I can reach the knob that's in the front. So there's something I'm willing to give up if I get what I absolutely need.
May I add a sentence to that answer? This is Bonnie.
Absolutely.
So it's important to distinguish between two kinds of housing. Housing that is built with federal money or that has rental subsidies that are project-based, that are part of the building, have to meet the standards of the original Disability Rights Act, Section 504, which is to say at least 5% of the units in the building. So if there are 100 apartments in the building, at least 5 of them have to have roll-in showers and have to have both kitchens and bathrooms that have enough space for a wheelchair user to turn around. In buildings that do not have, and 2%, an additional 2% of the units have to have features that make the apartments usable for people who have hearing disabilities or visual disabilities. In the vast majority of apartments that do not have any federal funding, they have to meet the Fair Housing Access requirements, and those are on page 2 of the first document that Jessica sent out to you that I gave to her. And in those apartments, the kitchens and bathrooms have to be usable, which is less accessibility than in a 504 apartment. So by usable, you have to be able to roll through the kitchen. The stove has to have its knobs or its handles on the front of the stove, so you don't have to reach across to the stove. The kitchen has to be wide enough so that you can open the doors to the cabinets. You can open the refrigerator door, but not so wide that it gives you turnaround space. Similarly, in the bathroom, you're not necessarily going to find turnaround space, but you have to be able to use the sink and the shower or the tub and the toilet with your wheelchair in the bathroom so that you can close the door. when the Fair Housing Act was being debated in the years leading up to 1988, the question was whether all new buildings were going to be required to have fully accessible, that is to say 504 accessible bathrooms and kitchens and apartments. And the advocates knew that it was very unlikely that Congress was going to accept that in all new market rate, private market apartments. And so the negotiated position, which is in the Fair Housing Laws, is this modified accessibility. So it's not necessarily going to work if, as Sarah, you need a roll-in shower. But it will work for the majority of people with disabilities. And as I said before, all federally financed housing has to have roll-in showers. I personally am living in a market rate condo, a 1916 building that was renovated in the 90s. And my one-bedroom apartment has two full baths, one of which has what could easily be made into a roll-in shower. It just has a lip, you know, a one-inch lip, so it's possible to create a small ramp over that lip, and the shower itself is large enough to function as a roll-in shower. So, and as I said before, if you've got apartment buildings that were built for first occupancy after 1991 and they're not accessible, as is the one that that you described, Julie, it's definitely worthwhile contacting a fair housing expert, either local or national, and I'm happy to, you know, send out more contacts, because if lawyers who represent you will represent you for free. It's the housing developer and the housing provider who has to pay the attorney's fees for successful Fair Housing Access lawsuits. And I really encourage you to follow through.
Absolutely. Thank you, Bunny. I had no idea. That's good to know.
Sure. And we certainly need more accessible apartments and accessible single-family housing.
Absolutely.
Okay, the next question is if there are resources available to help pay for modifications if the disabled person can't afford it.
I'm sorry, this is Julie.
Go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. This is Julie, and I wanted to answer that question. The one thing in this wonderful apartment that I'm living in that didn't have is the roll-in shower. I have been living here for 3 years. I can get into the shower with a great deal of, well, it's difficult, and I realize that I'm not going to be able to do this much longer when my MS progresses or just as I age, so I wanted the roll-in shower and didn't have the money. I found out that my Medicaid program, my state, will pay, will do the funds for installing the roll-in shower. And, yay, I'll be getting that done in the next 2-3 weeks. I am really thrilled about that. But, yes, the state does have the money for modifications.
Great. Was there another speaker who was going to address that?
In many cases, when you're applying for funds, you have to, like, there's, in Massachusetts, for example, there's something called Title 7B. State funds available to make your house accessible. But you have to have proven that you look literally everywhere else before you come to them. So whenever you are looking for funds, my number one suggestion is, even if the answer is no, document when, where, and who you spoke to, so that you can prove to whomever eventually does agree to fund your modifications that you look everywhere else. It's important because in cases they say, well, there's funds, we have funds available, but, you know, maybe funds available elsewhere. And if you can prove that there are no funds available elsewhere, then they're more likely to fund you.
And this is Bonnie. There are funds available Some of them are formal and some of them are informal. So the community development block grant is often used by cities to set up modification funds. Unfortunately, Congress has slashed the community development block grant source of funds for all cities across the country, but it's worth checking with the mayor's office on housing, or the state housing office, or the state community development office to see if it has funds. People have also been successful in getting local volunteer organizations like the Kiwanis and faith organizations like churches and synagogues to have their members, especially carpenters and electricians and, you know, who want to do good deeds to create the kinds of modifications that people have needed.
And this is Robin. I'm going to jump in, too. Julie mentioned that the state is going to pay for it. And I would say that under many Medicaid waiver programs, home modification is a covered service. So, again, that's something to make sure that you look into.
Great. So another question that came in is as follows. When a person or corporation is both the landlord and service provider for a person with a disability, is the landlord required to provide the physical items needed, such as a ramp or a walk-in shower, or is that the person's responsibility? And does the answer to that question change if the landlord has advertised that the home is for persons with disabilities? So I'll open that up for anyone to respond to.
This is Bonnie. The answer to that is absolutely yes. The landlord is responsible for providing housing that's usable by people with disabilities, especially if they're advertising that they provide housing for people with disabilities. And even if they identify the population of people with disabilities as people with mental disabilities, for example, or intellectual disabilities, that does not absolve them of their responsibility to provide accessible, usable housing.
Any other speakers like to respond to that before I pose the next question? Okay. So the next question is, do reasonable modifications and accommodations apply to private landlords as well as publicly funded landlords and housing complexes?
Yes. The answer to that is yes as well.
Okay. And the last question that we have today was for Bonnie, but I'll again open it up for any speaker to respond to. Are you aware of other cities that require a certain percentage of apartments to be accessible?
I am not. But, you know, the laws themselves require all federally funded housing to incorporate the 5%, 2% rule, and as I said before, all new multifamily buildings, whether they have elevators or not, if they have five or more units, have to have accessible units. If it's an elevator building, 100%. If it's non-elevator
units. That's the way it is in Boston, too. If you're in a multifamily dwelling of five or more units, then they have to make it.
Okay, well, thank you for all of the questions. Unfortunately, we are out of time for today's call, so the timing on that is perfect. I hope that our participants have found this to be an excellent opportunity for learning. Thank you to our speakers for your engaging and informative presentations, and again to our participants for joining the call and also for your excellent questions. As I mentioned at the start of the call, this is the first in a series of five calls, which will continue to address pertinent issues related to home and community-based long-term services and supports, including topics such as cost and payment, assessment, advocacy, etc. The next call in the series will take place this summer, so I recommend keeping an eye out for more information about registering for that event. For those of you who are interested, a recording of today's call as well as the call materials will be available for free on the Consumer Voice website over the next few days. And additionally, if you'd like a CD recording of the call and a copy of the materials, that will be available for purchase for $5 plus shipping and handling. also on the Consumer Voice website. So I'll say it one last time. I encourage you all to visit our website, www.theconsumervoice.org, to learn more about the work that we're doing, access our free resources, and see how you can get involved at state and the national level to improve quality care and life for consumers across care settings. Thank you again to everyone for being on today's call, and have a wonderful rest of your day.